Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, dozens of deported servicemen and women gathered in Mexico to celebrate Veterans Day. We'll have a report from there. While World War II was fought in Europe and the Pacific, there were German POWs housed right here in Illinois. And the situation was not always as contentious as you might think, at least in one town.
And they said, boys, do you know, we're not going to have enough help to run this canning factory. What are we going to do? So there was another farmer, and I forget exactly who it was. He says, well, why don't you guys bring in some German POWs?
Also, a southern Illinois town with a racist past. A reporter visited the community of Anna to find out what happened back then and if things have improved today. And we'll have the story of a camp in Illinois designed for kids with type 1 diabetes. That and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, has college outpriced many students? We'll hear about a new study. Also, a group of military veterans who have been recently deported still celebrated Veterans Day. They did it in Mexico. We'll have a report. And did you know that there were World War II POW camps in Illinois? Stick around, we'll have all that and more on this week's episode. Well, here on Statewide, we try to remember and even celebrate the history of Illinois, but some of that history is ugly and shameful. Take, for example, what are known as sundown towns, where it was understood African Americans should be out of the city limits by the evening hours. And honestly, they weren't welcome much during the day either. There's not anything that can be done to change the past, but what about now and the future in those places? Logan Jaffe is a reporter with ProPublica. She recently visited a community in southern Illinois, the small Union County town of Anna, population about 4,000. Anna was known as a sundown town back in the day. Some even used the spelling of the name Anna, A-N-N-A, to make clear that blacks should stay out. We'll get into that in a few minutes. I talked with Logan Jaffe about what she found in Anna. Logan, what made you decide to take on this story?
Years ago, maybe about 5 years ago, I had read a book about sundown towns, aptly titled Sundown Towns, and it was written by a man named James Lowen. He is from Decatur, Illinois. And actually, I believe that Anna, Illinois, is the first town mentioned in his book about sundown towns. And it actually starts in a similar way that I experienced in real life about two decades later after he wrote that book. And that's initially what got me curious about Anna in particular. And I think, you know, on another level, I've always been really interested in legends and myths and lore and the backstories for why things are named the way they are. When it's applied to something like ANNA, which is something that I heard that a lot of people know about, but also don't know about, that's the space that I was very interested in exploring and learning more.
And you write about your first conversation with somebody when you came to town, and this term ANNA, spelling of the town Anna, came up in that conversation.
It did. It was my first experience, my first time meeting somebody in Anna. Actually, I had gotten into town, you know, dropped my stuff off at the Super 8 Motel, and then I was just going to go and get some dinner. And my original plan was actually to start reporting the next day. I went to Main Street in Anna because I wanted to get some dinner, sat down at the bar of a restaurant there, and, you know, got to talking to people around me, and I asked the person next to me after, you know, a couple minutes of conversation, I said, tell me about this town. And then the man replied, well, you know how this town is called Anna? And at that moment, at that moment, my heart sank a little, and I was thinking to myself, is he going to say this out loud right now? And then the next thing out of his mouth was, Anna stands for ain't no N-word allowed. And he said that word in full. I just sat there trying to take that in, I'm not entirely sure exactly how I responded right after that. But what shocked me about it was that it was very casually said, like very matter-of-factly, what prompted me to start asking around to a lot of different people, whoever I could meet in Anna, really, if they had also heard that.
What kind of perception did you have of the town before you made the first visit?
I really wasn't sure. I really didn't know. I honestly figured it was just it's a normal small town. I don't know. I mean, it's in southern Illinois. It didn't strike me in any particularly unique way other than I knew that it had a certain sundown town history, but there are many towns that have sundown histories. You know, for my first visit or two to Anna, I wasn't trying to work on a particular story at all. I didn't even know that this was going to end up to be a story. I wasn't assuming that, oh, let me go to Anna and get my story. It took a couple different visits for me to figure out whether there was a story there at all. You know, the more and more people that I spoke with in Anna had acknowledged that they had, you know, known about ANNA. So it wasn't just the first person, you know, telling me ANNA at the bar, the restaurant that night. It was the fact that over and over again, people knew but didn't know what exactly happened.
We're talking with Logan Jaffe. She's a reporter for ProPublica. She wrote about the town of Anna, Illinois in a recent story and taking a look back at its history as what was known as a sundown town and where it is today. And Logan, I think it's interesting you mentioned that Anna is not necessarily that much different from a lot of other communities. Racism is prevalent north, south, in between. But this is one of those locations that does have an especially notorious past. You get into some of that, how a black man was lynched for a crime that I believe was committed in or around the town at one point.
Correct. Yeah. We're talking about an incident that happened in 1909 in Cairo, you know, about 35 miles south of Anna at the state's southernmost tip. In 1909, a white woman who was from Anna, a young white woman, her name was also coincidentally Anna, was found murdered in an alley. And a couple days later, a black man named William James was lynched in the middle of Cairo's commercial district. And this was an event that was attended by the newspaper at the time, the Cairo Bulletin, estimated thousands of people came out to take part in this and to be present for it.
It seems to me that when incidents like this happen, where a black man assumed guilty of a violent crime, but I guess we don't know because he did not go to trial, that incident resonates for decades. It makes maybe some people who harbor racist feelings feel a bit more vindicated, like, look what this person did. I'm right to feel this way. Do you think that's what happened in Anna?
Well, let me bring in the perspective of the local newspaper in Anna at the time. It's difficult to say exactly how people in Anna felt or if they felt vindicated at the time of the lynching. But actually, if you're looking at it through the perspective of the newspaper, the headline a few days after the lynching in Cairo said, "Well done, Cairo." So I mean, I guess that is a very explicit endorsement of those actions. And in oral histories that I've read from people in Union County who remember the lynching and what happened in Anna after that, there's a story that one man tells. He remembers the night after the lynching when a smaller mob of white Anna men went to a nearby quarry in Anna that employed a number of black people. And the workers, I am quoting the newspaper here, fled to the woods and they hadn't been seen for days. And in the oral history interview, the person says, you know, all of the black people were ran out of town after the Anna Pelley incident and the lynching in Cairo.
Word travels fast in a small town, so I'm sure your arrival and you're starting to talk to people that probably got around a bit. What did you hear from people, those that you were talking to? Were they open to discussing the town's past and what's going on now, or were they a little more tight-lipped about it?
Well, it's interesting because my first couple trips there, I was honestly just trying to get to know the town as a whole. When I would bring up and try to ask people and assess, okay, how extensive is this ANNA thing? Is it really a thing, or was the ANNA repeated to me at the bar, was that a fluke? I really was trying to get information about what happened. I met a lot of people who were just as interested in finding out about the story of ANNA as I was. You know, many people said, tell us what you find, because we don't know.
You did find some evidence that things have improved, at least to some level, in the town of Anna through the years, a little bit more of an open community.
Yeah. So in 2016, a woman named Easter Smith, who's a Black woman, moved to Anna with her 6 children. And they had reservations about moving there because they had heard about ANNA, but Easter was really willing to give it a shot. She wanted a safe place to raise her kids and to have a family. When I spoke to her, she said, honestly, I wish that I had moved to Anna sooner. She says that the community has very much supported her. And there's been incidents that have really bothered and upset the family, kind of these casual, everyday comments and interactions. You know, there, she told me a story about how a couple years ago, a couple students at the high school in Anna made a fake Instagram account and would anonymously, you know, roast classmates and post their pictures. And one of the comments about one of her children, it was the eldest son, you know, said something like, you know, you're Anna's Jackie Robinson, calling him the N-word. He is a very talented athlete. That's not something to be taken lightly. It's not something that the family has taken lightly. But Easter said that she was very encouraged that a lot of white parents spoke up about it and told the administrators how upset that they were about that post and that was not okay. And the fact that the school administration disciplined those students that were involved, it tells you something. It's complicated. I think how much or how little a community changes. And what I was hoping to do and what I was focusing on was trying to just hear from as many different people I talk in the piece, which is written in the first person, and I acknowledge my perspective as an outsider. And I'm, you know, I write in the piece, I'm not claiming to know the full story of Anna, but it's interesting because I've gotten a couple of responses from people who have said, only because you're an outsider have you been able to actually ask the questions that you did, and that it'd be more difficult if somebody were an insider to do that story.
I thought it was interesting, too. You spoke with the mayor of Anna, I quoted him, Steve Hartline is his name,
yeah.
And he mentioned, I'm going to read what he had to say here, it's a shame that wording is even out there when it comes to Anna. He calls it really sad and says, I'm just sorry we have to talk about that. That is not the Anna I know. I'm assuming there's a lot of people who feel that way as well, that the past is the past. Let's leave it there. Your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that. I mean, that saying or that belief and that mindset existed 150 years ago as well. Why do we talk about that? Why do we need to bring it up? When I would try to find information and try to pinpoint the story and do research in Anna and in Union County, there was no mention about ANNA. There was barely a mention of Anna's racial history in any of the local history books that I had read in the historical society. So it kind of goes back to this knowing and not knowing. And the question that I keep thinking of and keep coming back to is, for people who believe that we are over the past, how do we know that if we are over the past, if we don't know what specifically happened? How can we say for sure that this isn't something worth talking about because we've moved beyond that if we don't entirely embrace and understand what we are moving beyond?
So what do you want people to take away from this story?
You know, in my mind, I had an image of somebody like Easter Smith, who, before she decided to move to Anna, was Googling and Googling and trying to find information about what exactly happened. Like, why is this myth here? And she couldn't really find information about what happened, about a documented history of what happened to give Anna that reputation. And part of me in my head was writing it for future Easters. Not with the motivation in any way to discourage, because there is truth and there are facts behind myths. It could be the scenario that if you're able to put facts and truth and knowledge behind a myth and behind a narrative and behind a reputation, maybe you don't need AN and AA anymore. Maybe people stop saying it. I don't know. I don't know what all of the fallout and the aftermath and the future of Anna will be. I feel like it's not my place. But, you know, Anna is unique and also both not unique in a lot of ways. And I want to be clear that there are sundown towns all over the state. They're not just in Southern Illinois. They're all over the country. You know, in fact, in Dr. Lowen's book, Sundown Towns, I think he writes or suggests that the state of Oregon was an entire sundown state at one point. There are ways and different methods that a town has become sundown at various points in time. Some of them are more violent. Some of them are more public than others. You know, there are towns in the northern part of the state and Chicago suburbs where I bet if you were to look in the land deeds and the housing deeds, there would be clauses that say only Caucasians are allowed to live here. So there are various methods and they're all to the same effect, which is to keep a place intentionally white. And that's something that people are still doing in some ways. Like, this is not a phenomenon of the past, but it looks different and it's pervasive throughout our entire country.
Logan Jaffe is a reporter with ProPublica. Her story on the Southern Illinois town of Anna is available now, and we have a link at our website at statewideshow.com. Coming up next, we'll travel to Mexico, where deported U.S. veterans got together this past week. You're listening to Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We'll hear a report that finds college is just too expensive for many. We'll also hear some solutions. Also coming up, an Illinois man tells us that German POWs were housed in the state during World War II. That's all ahead. Dozens of deported military veterans celebrated Veterans Day in Tijuana, Mexico, with a special guest. The Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth traveled to the border to meet with her fellow vets, and she vowed to keep fighting in Congress to bring them back home. Maria Ines Zamudio filed this report from Tijuana.
Dozens of deported veterans gathered around Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth during a special Veterans Day event a few miles east of downtown Tijuana. They took a moment of silence to honor the soldiers who've died, including Valerie Salazar, an active Marine who died 2 years ago. Her father, Robert Salazar, stood next to Duckworth. He was deported in 2005. It was an emotional day inside the Deported Veterans Support House. Veterans and their families gathered to share their stories with Duckworth. The stories were eerily similar. The veterans were born in Mexico, but raised in the U.S. They enrolled and served in the military, but were later deported following a felony conviction.
Well, they all touch my heart. The fact that they have had to watch their families grow up from a long way away, the fact that so many of them served and volunteered to serve, the fact that many of them thought they had citizenship and then found out later that they did not have citizenship or that they can't get their health care.
The Illinois senator told the group about several bills she's introduced to help deported veterans and their families. If passed, the bills would create a visa program to bring deported veterans home and create a temporary visa so that deported veterans can cross the border into San Diego to visit VA hospitals, among others. Veterans Day is especially personal for Duckworth. She's an Iraq combat veteran. And today, 15 years ago, she almost died when the helicopter she was co-piloting was shut down by insurgents. She calls today her alive day.
It always reminds me that I didn't get left behind. And I feel like these guys got left behind. And so I wanted to be here with them to show them that they matter and that I appreciate their service and that there are many, many Americans who truly honor their service and sacrifice for our nation and that we are not going to leave them behind.
All right, basically, I want to thank all the guys that made it here. I know a couple guys said they couldn't make it because of work, and then they actually went out of their way to be here. I had a family.
And the deported veterans here said they were honored to have a combat veteran spend the day with them and to hear that she's committed to helping them.
I want to thank Senator Tammy Duckworth for making the trip down here. Like we said earlier, she could have been anywhere in the world. She could have been, but she chose to be here with her brothers.
That's Chicago veteran Miguel Perez Jr. He lived in Tijuana for a year after being deported. He was able to return home after a pardon allowed him to get his citizenship, and he traveled back to support the deported veterans who are still fighting to get back into the country. Claudia Ramirez also traveled from Chicago to attend the Veterans Day celebration. Her father is a veteran. He was in the Marines between 1969 and 1971, but he was deported following a felony conviction over two decades ago.
I was quiet for so long because I didn't want people to judge me on my father's actions.
But she's now ready to speak about deported veterans. She wants her dad in Chicago, especially since he was diagnosed with cancer last year. She says he needs to be close to his family.
I've been fighting to have a dad since I was 17 years old. Now I'll keep fighting. Every girl needs a father.
For Ramirez, seeing Miguel Perez Jr. return to Chicago and Senator Duckworth in Tijuana listening to deported veterans has renewed hope.
And Senator Duckworth did that. She gave me that ray of hope. And who knows if it happens, but just the point that she's here and that she cares, that's important.
But the road to bringing her dad back to Chicago will be long and challenging. Among the hundreds of veterans who have been deported, only a few have been able to return home.
That was Maria Ines Zamudio with that report. Northern Illinois was home to several German POW camps during World War II. Chase Cavanaugh has more on a Hampshire man who got to know one camp in more ways than one.
In 1944, Hampshire was home to the J.B. and Derridean cannery, which packed local peas and sweet corn. John Fenzel Jr., then a 12-year-old paperboy, overheard the city mayor and farm managers discussing a labor shortage at one of the local restaurants.
And I'm sitting at the counter, and they said, boys, do you know we're not going to have enough help to run this canning factory? What are we going to do? So there was another farmer, and I forget exactly who it was. He says, well, why don't you guys bring in some German POWs?
There were soon tents and barracks, and in April 1944, prisoners from Camp Grant and Rockford came to Hampshire. They included volunteers with the German Africa Corps captured in Libya. More than 200 prisoners worked in the field and cannery, but base authorities wanted to make sure the Germans were kept occupied. That's when the camp's colonel paid Fenzel's father a visit.
Would you be against your son coming into the POW camp twice a day delivering newspapers, and at the same time cutting out anything that pertained with murder or rape? The dad says, no, I'm not against it. It'd be a good thing. The kid'll learn something.
And learn he did. Fenzel became well acquainted with Hans Finkel, a POW who ran the camp's PX, essentially a general store. Finkel helped Fenzel with his schoolwork and recounted stories from back home. Eventually, Finkel, who Fenzel said had noticed his fellow Germans were skilled at woodworking, asked the boy if he would help bring in supplies such as sandpaper and varnish. Fenzel said he had a mixed reaction to the request.
Hans, I can't bring carving knives in. And he says, Johann, just take a minute, look on the counter, what do you see? I say, oh my God, straight razors. He says, they have straight razors. If they're going to pull anything, don't you think they'd use straight razors? I said, you got a point.
Fenzel agreed to bring in the supplies and was paid in Hershey bars and tobacco products that he could sell at his father's garage. Among Fenzel's mementos from that time is a wood carving by POW Ludwig Kafka, an aircraft mechanic who made the piece out of part of an orange crate. It contains photos of Fenzel at a young age and the motto, Bete und Arbeite, pray and work. Fenzel says the POWs were quite religious and made their way every Sunday to the local Catholic and Lutheran churches. Once the services let out, Fenzel said something special would happen.
Whatever church let out first, they would meet in the center of town and they would sing, give you a concert, like Lily Marlene and Silent Night in German.
After the war, Fenzel enlisted in the army, and in the mid-1950s was deployed to Germany to defend against a possible Soviet advance. Fenzel said he tried to reestablish contact with Hans Finkel and Ludwig Kafka, but army duties kept him from being able to see them out in Berlin or Vienna. Fenzel said he was able to meet Finkel's family in the 1990s, after the Berlin Wall came down, but Finkel had unfortunately passed away a month prior. Later, in 2005, Fenzel was able to get in touch with Kafka's daughter, but he said she didn't initially believe his story about Kafka's life in the POW camp. She asked Fenzel to identify her father in a family photo.
Mr. Fenzel, Herr Fenzel, pick out Ludwig. I did. I said, I'm Papa. And then she hugged and kissed me. She believed me finally, because she couldn't believe that he would be involved in stuff like that.
There's little trace of the camp left in Hampshire, so Fenzel has become a de facto expert on the subject. He said Germans regularly inquired about the camp.
I had two U-boat commanders come and talk to me. I had to show them everything. And they couldn't believe that we treated prisoners like we did.
Fenzel continues to tell his story and said the cordial experience in Hampshire between the POWs and Americans hints at something greater.
We're all body and soul, so to speak. And you know, they're the same as we are in a way. You take away some of this outside response that they have or this outside action that they perceive or put forth. We're all the same when it comes right down to it.
I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
Illinois and Iowa will work with four other states to study the availability of alternative fuel along Interstate 80. They've received a federal grant and will each contribute some of their own money to figure out where electric vehicles can be charged and where compressed natural gas is available. And Herb Trix explains.
From coast to coast, Interstate 80 is 2,900 miles long. Eastern half, known as the Mid-America Corridor, goes from New Jersey through Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois to the western border of Iowa, 163 miles in Illinois and 306 miles in Iowa. Christopher Schmidt, air quality manager for the Illinois Department of Transportation, says they want to find out where alternative fuel is available, because right now drivers of these vehicles often suffer from something called range anxiety.
So that's a real phrase, yeah. Range anxiety, through a lot of national studies, ends up being one of the top five, if not top three, reasons why somebody wouldn't purchase an electric vehicle or, let's say, alternative fuel vehicle. So the idea with this project is to make those gaps disappear. In Illinois, we're in pretty good shape. You could travel from the Quad Cities to the Indiana border fairly easy in an electric vehicle with proper infrastructure along the way, depending on what level of charge you started out the trip with and what level you wanted to enter Indiana with.
Stu Anderson works for the Iowa Department of Transportation as the director of the Planning, Programming, and Modal Division. He says the range of the current early generation electric vehicles often depends on the temperature and the wind.
We have some charging infrastructure, which is called level two chargers, which charge at a slower rate and take longer to charge. But then what really we need on these corridors for long-distance travel are these called DC fast-charging stations, direct current fast-charging stations, which do a really high charge in a short period of time.
Iowa currently has just three of the DC-3 or fast-charge stations, in Council Bluffs, Des Moines, and Coralville. And Tesla has some stations for its own vehicles.
So what this planning effort will do is really try to identify the ideal location to fill in gaps and also help identify partnerships to get those facilities developed.
Schmidt says to be considered available for drivers on I-80, alternative fuel stations must be located within 5 miles of the interstate.
We were just in a conference in Detroit with a lot of the regional states, and the concept basically now is there's really no bad place to put EV charging. You know, it's needed everywhere, and you're going to see demand as long as it's connected to an interstate.
Anderson cautions, though, that the cost of connecting with the appropriate electrical service to fast-charge electric vehicles can be very expensive.
And, of course, it's more than just the charging infrastructure. These sites also need to have amenities for the public, some sort of shelter, restroom facilities, adequate lighting. Ideally, there's some, like, restaurant or food availability as well. So that all comes into the discussion as well.
And those three fast charge sites in Iowa, two of them are located at gas stations, while the third is in the parking lot of a Walmart store. Schmidt says this is a unique opportunity for the six states along I-80.
One thing that I'd emphasize with everybody, you know, when you hear about autonomous vehicles and that revolution is coming, there's not a lot of manufacturers that are creating those vehicles with gas-powered engines. It doesn't make a lot of sense to take gasoline energy, convert it to electric, and have it run all those sensors and all the things that are needed. Those vehicles are going to run on an electric engine and eventually hydrogen converted to electric. So that's where we're headed.
The multi-state collaboration includes the Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois, U.S. Department of Energy, and Trillium, a company based in Oklahoma that develops and installs alternative fuel systems. It's a division of the Loves Company, which owns truck stops and stores in 41 states. I'm Herb Trix.
This is Statewide. State disinvestment in higher education has put a college degree out of reach for many Illinois students. That's a key finding from a new series of priced-out reports from the Partnership for College Completion. Peter Medlin has details.
Before they dug into the numbers, Kyle Westbrook says they wanted to try to reframe the conversation around the cost of college in Illinois. He's the executive director of the Partnership for College Completion. He says universities and lawmakers have often looked at higher ed funding from the point of view of the schools. And while it's important to talk about program cuts, layoffs, and maintenance, they wanted the reports to be from the students' perspective.
It shouldn't be surprising that as higher education has become much less affordable over the last 15 years, particularly for low-income students, it shouldn't be a surprise that we see that impact being felt on students who are least able to afford to attend college.
The organization says state funding for public universities has fallen 50% since 2002. The reports look at three student groups who experience affordability challenges: Black, Latinx, and students who live in rural communities. The number of Black students enrolled at Illinois public and private nonprofit universities fell by thousands over the past decade. Westbrook says they were also dismayed to find Black students disproportionately take on loans and debt at higher rates to fund their education.
It's not even close between where Black students are borrowing on average and where Latinx and white students are borrowing. I mean, that gap was pretty substantial and surprising to us to see. And obviously the implications for generations of students.
Westbrook said because of these findings, they believe the state should change how higher ed is funded. The reports propose changes to incentivize public universities and community colleges to recruit underrepresented low-income and minority students.
Do all groups of students see our public institutions as viable options? I think the answer to that is no.
This spring, Illinois lawmakers passed a direct admissions pilot program. This would automatically admit students to participating public colleges and universities if they finished in the top 10% of their class, along with a few other requirements. The report advocates for similar programs, especially if they're expanded to further help those underrepresented students. The report also recommends scaling back merit-based scholarship programs in favor of increasing need-based aid like MAP.
What we end up doing often with our merit-based programs is we end up sort of making the rich richer.
That's because of how much those scholarships factor in test scores like the ACT and SAT. Westbrook says those aren't even good barometers of college success. He says grade point averages are more accurate. And it's because he says wealthy schools can offer more test prep courses and tutors. Once they're in college, Black and Latinx students are also disproportionately tossed into zero-credit developmental courses.
Obviously, students are spending their money, their precious financial aid on those courses, and we know that there's better ways to do it.
For that, the report proposes transitional math and science classes in high school to keep up academic momentum going into college. One area where Illinois higher ed succeeds is in bachelor's degree completion for transfer students. But Westbrook says it's important to disaggregate that data. Latinx students are much less likely to transfer at all. They're less likely to take out loans and more likely to be first-gen college students. Another group much less likely to transfer are students from rural communities. Westbrook said these students are too often left out of higher ed discussions in Illinois. That could partially be due to shifting demographics, seeing rural populations shrink more and more.
If state policy can't reverse those macro trends, state policy certainly should not accelerate them.
But Westbrook says the true cost of college goes far beyond tuition or room and board.
There are all of these hidden costs of college that can either enrich the experience for students or can make the experience not as impactful as it could be or as it is for certain groups of students who can afford those opportunities.
Those include unpaid internships or study abroad trips inaccessible to many students. I'm Peter Medlin.
Remember to check out our website at statewideshow.com. All of our episodes are there with information about the reports and conversations you hear each week. We have more of Statewide coming up. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, a camp for kids with type 1 diabetes. And we'll delve into politics and look at how one Illinois congressman went from being a Donald Trump skeptic to a solid backer of the president. But next, Chicago has a lot of trees, but it's been losing them at an astonishing rate. Some experts think the region has lost as many as 13 million trees in the past decade alone. Rebuilding that treasure is a critical environmental challenge, and one that needs all hands on deck. From our member station WBEZ, contributor Ken Davis has more.
Trees are sometimes called the lungs of our planet. It's because of the way they absorb carbon dioxide and exhale it back into the atmosphere as life-giving oxygen. And while they're at it, they gather up pollutants and give calming shade. But that's if you have one.
All our trees are gone. Half our block is naked. Our street used to be lined nicely, like you were coming down a little tunnel. No, not anymore.
In the Dunning neighborhood on the northwest side, Kathy and Abel Gomez are out in front, pointing to a big hole in the sky.
The landscape in this neighborhood changed since I've been here. I moved here in 2002. Since then, we have 5 trees removed just right in this area here.
And I understand that they're cutting them down because they're sick, but we're cutting more than we're planting.
Cutting down a lot more, in fact. Chicago's street trees were hit really hard by the emerald ash borer insect because Chicago had overplanted this kind of tree in the past 30 years or so. Arborists call that a monoculture. And this one little insect is pretty much killing all of the ash trees. The numbers we got from Streets and Sanitation, which oversees Chicago's forestry department, confirm it. Forestry removed an average of 13,200 trees every year in the last 5 years, and they replanted fewer than 4,000. Think about that. On average, each of those years saw a net loss of almost 10,000 parkway trees.
Trees are essential to us.
As we wander around the city, we're finding a lot of people who feel deep connections to their trees.
We can't live without them.
In Chatham, John Marshall's pretty emphatic.
They bring oxygen. They bring shade in the summertime. We need all the trees. You know, like over in Brazil, where they burnt down the rainforest. I mean, we need them.
And here's Linda Banks, a few blocks north.
I would not want to imagine a neighborhood without trees. Not at all. It's a blessing.
Now, I know we're throwing a lot of numbers at you, but there are two more big ones. Let's climb into our imaginary helicopter here and take a look down over 7 counties, from Navy Pier all the way out to Harvard in McHenry County. All the trees you're seeing is what's known as our canopy, and it's shrinking fast. Here's our first big number. Imagine 13 million trees lost to the ash plague just in this region. And that brings us to our second number, 22 million. Let's set down over there in Lyle at Morton Arboretum. It's a breezy September morning, and Lydia Scott's invited us to visit with her under a massive oak tree next to Meadow Lake. She heads the Chicago Region Trees Initiative, which is housed here at the Arboretum, and she has a daunting task. The CRTI wants to encourage and cajole us all into planting a whole lot of trees.
And it works out to be about 2 trees per person between now and 2050.
Per Chicago resident?
Per regional resident. We're talking 11 million people, so that would be about 22 million trees we need to get planted by 2050.
Wow, that's a lot of trees. A lot of trees means a lot of people are going to have to get involved. For instance, if you're a Chicagoan with no tree in the parkway in front of your house, you can request one. As we talked with people around the city, we consistently found folks who thought they had to adjust to a treeless life.
Don't be barking. There you go. Barking means I want to play with you.
It's just past dusk, and outside his Portage Park home, Byron Rodas is out walking his dog. A lot of your neighbors don't have trees, and looks like nobody's been asking to get them replanted or anything.
Oh, I didn't know you can get them replanted.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
The city does that?
Yeah. You can call 311, and they will replace the tree for free.
Oh, well, that's news to me. I could have a new tree up here.
Turns out Streets and Sand doesn't automatically replace trees, nor do they reach out to homeowners to tell them they can have them replaced, even though that information is available on their website. That might seem like bad public policy, but a lot of tree experts think it's a good idea, because if you put a tree in front of a house where it isn't wanted, where nobody's going to take care of it, it'll just die, and you've wasted a tree. But the government planting trees for us is only a small part of this picture. As Lydia Scott points out, most trees aren't on public lands at all.
70% of the trees across our region are located on private property. So it's you and I, the individual homeowner, that can have the biggest impact by planting and caring for the trees that we have so they can live longer and be healthier and provide bigger benefits.
So how about planting a tree in your own yard? And if you're someone in a position to influence landscaping at your workplace, how about squirting in some canopy there? It costs the city of Chicago about $500 to plant a replacement tree. The plan for 2019 is for forestry to plant about 4,000 of them, so about $2 million worth. But who's to say it couldn't be more? If lots of Chicagoans file a request for a replacement tree, maybe Mayor Lightfoot's people will notice. So if you've got a blank space in your parkway, and if you'd be willing to care for a tree, file a request at 311. And think of it as your vote for more trees in Chicago. For WBEZ, this is Ken Davis.
With the impeachment investigation moving into a more public phase this past week, members of Congress are calibrating their responses. Rodney Davis's district includes wide swaths of rural central Illinois where President Trump is popular, but it also includes college towns filled with Democratic voters, and Davis was reelected by a slim margin last year. As Brian Mackey reports, it's against that backdrop that Davis has traveled from being a Trump objector to a Trump supporter.
Rodney Davis's journey to embracing Donald Trump is a lot like that of the Republican Party as a whole. After the Access Hollywood video came out right before the 2016 election, Davis withdrew his endorsement and said he wouldn't vote for Trump. Fast forward 3 years, and Davis is flying with the president on Air Force One.
We're also glad to have with us representatives Rodney Davis.
At a recent speech in Chicago, Trump praised Davis and his fellow Illinois Republicans, Mike Bost and Darren LaHood.
Where are they? The three of them. They're warriors for us, for all of us.
Like most Republicans, Davis has become a defender and ally of the president, including on impeachment.
If a new precedent is set for this president, that they're going to impeach him just out of partisan politics, then what you will get in the future in this country is any time the House of Representatives is controlled by another party than the president, you will see an impeachment just because the precedent's being set today.
He acknowledges his view of Trump has evolved since that Access Hollywood tape.
I've gotten to know him better, know him personally. I like the president personally. I look forward to working with him on a regular basis and his administration. And I look forward to campaigning for his reelection because I think the results are astounding.
Davis says he doesn't hear anything wrong in the readout of the president's call with Ukraine, and he echoes other Republicans in complaining that the process has been unfair to Trump. But as firmly in the president's corner as Davis now is, he also works hard to maintain an image as someone who can work across the aisle. Just last week, he touted being named a gun violence prevention hero by the Brady campaign.
My district is a district that voted for President Trump by a small margin, at the same time voted for me in that election by a much larger margin. But my district was drawn to elect Democrats.
That is true. But while Davis did run 14 points ahead of Trump in 2016, last year the Democrats came within 1 point of claiming the seat. And it's a top target again for 2020. All of which raises the question, how will voters react to Davis's embrace of the president? Back in Springfield, in the middle of his district, few people seem to be focused on impeachment. On an unseasonably cold and snowy day, contractor Anthony Bartman is on his way to a job repairing doors at an apartment complex.
Trump's the worst or the less of two evils, I thought, at the beginning, but now it's kind of like, I know he's eccentric, but he's definitely out there. He's an oddball.
But when it comes to Davis and the president...
Honestly, I don't have an opinion on it. I don't have time to sit down and watch the news, what's going on. I'm so damn busy all day.
Turns out this is a pretty popular view around here, but there are others, like Tremaine Williams, who evaluate Davis separately from the president.
As far as what Rodney Davis is doing, I think he's doing a pretty good job. You know what I'm saying? Rodney Davis has been around for a while in Congress, so I know he knows what he's doing.
He basically says, in these polarized times, he understands why Davis is standing with Trump.
You know, you got Republicans versus Democrats, so the Republicans got to stick together.
So the big question for Davis and other lawmakers is whether the impeachment hearings prompt them to, once again, reevaluate their relationship with the president. I'm Brian Mackey.
Sending a child to overnight camp can be nerve-wracking for any parent. It's even scarier if they have a child with a chronic illness. And for Side Effects Public Media, Steph Whiteside reports on a camp in Illinois offering a safe option for kids who have type 1 diabetes.
Okay, ready? Follow me, okay? Put your hand down.
In the rolling hills of southern Illinois, stable hands get ready to lead a trail ride. Campers get a quick lesson and they're off. But not before counselors collect backpacks full of medical supplies.
And release the reins. So
you got the brakes on. There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Hold by the knot. Sweetie, hold
the
by
backpacks
the knot.
Show how Camp Beta is different from traditional summer camps. Counselors are dietetic students from Southern Illinois University, and the 26 kids are always accompanied by a nurse and a dietitian.
Our priority is to just let these kids come out and be kids and have fun and do some things that maybe they're not able to do all the time. Ride horses, go ziplining, kayaking, things like that, while we're kind of helping them learn how to do these things and still remain safe with type 1 diabetes.
That's diabetic educator and nurse Lisa Nation. She and her colleagues came up with the idea for the camp. Camp Beta is the only camp for type 1 kids in Southern Illinois. It's a short one, only 2 days, but unlike longer camps, it's free.
But there's quite a big cost associated with for the families with those longer camps. So we really wanted to make this inclusive for everyone in our region.
Because kids with type 1 diabetes don't produce any insulin, they rely on injections or an insulin pump to provide it. They need to test their blood sugar and adjust the dose based on food or activity, or risk going into diabetic shock. Amy Stout helped develop the camp, and she says it can be tough for parents to let go, even for a couple days.
The camp itself is for kids that often don't get a chance to go overnight with their friends even, because diabetes is well known to have low blood sugar reactions in the middle of the night.
That can make parents wary of letting their kids out of sight, especially when they can't be sure other adults know how to handle a diabetic emergency. Billy Crippen says Camp Beta is the only camp her daughter has attended, though she wants to go to others.
She's asked, church camp is actually right down the road from here, and she's asked to go, and it makes me a nervous wreck.
Daughter Taylor says she enjoys meeting other kids like her.
Just meeting all the people with diabetes like me and just like having somebody that knows what it feels like. I'm the only one at school that has diabetes, but...
Stout said that shared experience is a goal of Camp Beta. Kids can feel embarrassed about checking their blood sugar and taking insulin before they can eat. But at camp, she's seen kids change, including one girl who didn't want to wear her insulin pump.
Where she brought her insulin pens because she was going to kind of hide them and, you know, go into the bathroom, take her injections and come out to eat. And then when she saw all the rest of the kids were using their insulin pumps, she was like, oh, why didn't I bring my pump, you know?
Camp is also a break for parents who help their children manage the disease. That can be like having a full-time job. It's a task that doesn't stop, even at night, says Crippen.
When everybody else is tired, wants to wind down and go to sleep, somebody has to be vigilant in the night.
That can get tiring for parents and kids. Taylor admits that she sometimes avoids telling her parents when she has a low, though her younger sister often tells them for her.
There are some moments when I'm trying to hide my low so I could just do what normal kids normally just get to do.
And getting to have that kind of normal kid experience, even if it's only for a couple of days, is what Camp Beta is all about. Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
Wraps up this week statewide. Thanks for joining us and be with us again at this time. We'll bring you more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this program, you can find it at our website, statewideshow.com. All of our past episodes are there. If you'd like to hear our podcast, listen through the NPR One app. Crawford, Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.